You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm. I'm here today with Mark Lappin, the author of Pledge of Allegiance, a book recently published by Dutton. And it's a first novel, and I thought it would be interesting to go through the saga of first novelists with its author, because many of my listeners call in and ask me, in the way that I'm asked how a bill becomes a law, how a first novel gets written. This is an interesting case, because you started writing when?
This novel, or?
Mm-hmm.
I think the novel probably began in 1986.
Uh-huh. And you had already begun several careers, both in Japan and here, before publishing this book.
Well, the only thing I ever really wanted to be was a writer. However, I found it kind of difficult to find my story and find my voice, so I found various ways to support myself, all of which involved writing, but not fiction, alas.
Does... Having been in that particular circle of hell as well, I've worked in public relations, which I've read you've worked in, I always was afraid that doing that kind of writing would somehow blunt my ear or my soul or my voice. Did you have that fear?
Well, it certainly crossed my mind. On the other hand, it was the only thing that I could do part-time for a couple of hours a day and still have enough time to write.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I wasn't a surgeon.
No, all of us, you know, in one way or another, find one incorrect thing or another to do in order to support ourselves while hoping someday to write. Now, you'd written other novels before this.
No, I hadn't written, I'd never written another novel. I had written short stories.
But really,
I faced quite a struggle with writer's block, which went on... from the time I decided to write at the age of 15, probably till I broke through with this novel. And I was able to finish some things, which I was more or less satisfied with, actually less, I suppose.
Did a bell go off? How did you know that this one was it? Did you know before you finished? Was it an easy and surprising thing?
Yes, I knew. Well, this, what happened is that I finally quit the PR thing and decided to write full-time in 1986 with the help of my wife, who agreed to let me do this mad venture. And I began cranking out stories. I wrote about a dozen of them, and I began sending them off. I felt happy that I had finished them. I didn't feel that any of them were really great or exactly what I was working for, but I felt reasonably pleased with them. And I sent them off, and one by one they all came back. And when the last one came back, I was just feeling so terrible and depressed and kind of at a dead end. I went for a run, and I was just very much in touch with this despairing feeling. And I remembered an incident in my life that that gave me that feeling, which is... became the first chapter of this book. And so I thought, well, all right, I might as well write this story. Now I'm in this mood. So, and as soon as I started this story that became the first chapter of the book, I just felt I was in touch with something different.
Well, it's very interesting because I have supposed sometimes, especially with cases involving writer's block, that no matter how old you are, when you do finally go to do that first novel, it does involve returning to childhood in some form or another. And this novel, Mark Lappin's Pledge of Allegiance, is about a coming of age as more or less a red diaper baby and dealing with a father in the underground and the boy struggling through the world of being raised in a communist family. Now, is this autobiographical?
Well, the background is autobiographical. That is, my parents were indeed in the party My father was underground during the height of the McCarthy period. It was a very complex and difficult time for me. On the other hand, my actual life is much more boring, was much more boring than that of the protagonist in the novel. And I think that what was successful, what was really the key, was somehow to be able to use the factual background as the springboard into a fictional story, which is dramatic and hopefully reaches beyond my own little life.
I was speaking to a friend recently who has this background, and she has been writing about it too, Annie Bardak, a crime reporter frequently for Vanity Fair, whose response to her activist parents was to run as fast as possible into the arms of whatever FBI or mainstream American culture that would hear her and say, take me away from the communist crazies. Whereas this child in this book, Joshua, seems a relatively faithful boy. tell me.
Well, this was, and is still, quite an issue for me, that as a child, growing up in that environment, which was, in a sense, a kind of cult, I believed in the ideals, and I believed in the people. I still, in a way, believe in the people. That is, they were and are upright, good, disciplined, fine people, in a way. The ideals turned out to have been very, very flawed. I think I knew that really from quite an early age. But so I found it difficult to reject the background, I suppose, because of my loyalty to the people.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because in this book, the FBI agent who comes to persuade Joshua to tell whatever stories he can about his vanished father comes wielding a baseball bat and a baseball, sort of the purveyor of American culture.
Exactly.
To the child shutout.
Exactly. And many people say that he's a very sinister character. But in writing, I knew he was somewhat sinister, but I also thought he had an extremely attractive side, as he does to Josh. And there's no denying for me, and I think for many people, most people, that American culture has a very attractive and seductive side for outsiders as well as insiders.
Yes, this novel has a very peculiar attitude toward its men. I think maybe, God knows I'm strange enough, but the good humor man, guardian of Eskimo pies, the FBI agent with his baseball and his tickets to the Ebbets Field, these men all seem like seducers. You know, there's a very strong male seduction of the child in this book. I wondered if you could say anything at all about this.
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way. One of the givens, kind of the springboard of the story, is that the boy's own father is underground, is absent, and moreover, is not really very much of a male role model for him. So he is definitely on a quest to find someone who can give him the sort of strength and perhaps also the sort of love that he needs. He feels he needs to cope with what is a difficult situation. Unfortunately, the people he encounters in his fictional world, while they're willing to offer certain kinds of affection, don't really give him what he needs, or what can I say, are not without motives, ulterior motives, or hidden agendas. And so
I'm curious now, you know, I don't want to belabor this, but, you know, when I think about a novel about childhood, you know, I am inclined to go racing backwards in time and find almost preconscious imagery. I guess, famous book in this line is Call It Sleep, where everything beginning with the hot and cold water faucets almost feels mythological and half understood. This seems to be a very conscious narrative, not given too much mythologizing or poeticizing of experience. What made you decide that? I'm curious.
Well, I think that probably there is a mythic level to it and a symbolic level to it. And yet I wasn't at least very consciously manipulating it. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I'm aware of is that it follows a certain kind of quest for identity or hero mm-hmm. quest, mm-hmm. You might say, where in the end the protagonist does have to go down into the depths and seek for something.
Mm-hmm.
And although in a way this is a story about an initiation rite that goes very wrong for the child, still he does emerge with some token from this underworld, which is the baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So on that level, I think it's there is a kind of mythological level, but it is different from Call It Sleep, and as to why, I really can't tell. That's
I'm not talking about, I'm talking about the writing style rather than the content. You know, often when people are descending into their past, they'll be, I guess where I started thinking about this was when I thought about the Good Humor Man. At least my generation of Good Humor Men did not sell Eskimo pies. No such item on the Good Humor list. And I thought to myself, well, this is interesting in a certain way, that there would be in many the impulse to give us, a la Stanley Elkin or even Philip Roth, the whole list of what a Good Humor Man of that time sells. This is a book that kind of, in a certain way, eschews memory and nostalgia, while that is even part of its subject. And that intrigued me.
Hmm. All I can tell you really about that is, in a way, although the background, as I said, is autobiographical, I did not remember that much from these times. My family is not a record-keeping family. I didn't have a lot of snapshots. I didn't have a lot of people to talk to about it. And I had kind of created. It's more an act, much more an act of imagination than an act of memory. And so what appears on the Good Humor Man's truck, or indeed inside the Good Humor Man's truck, came out of my memory, out of whatever psychological factors were at work there.
What are you working on now? Did this novel, as they say, break the block?
Well, this is kind of a big question for me at the time, whether it did or didn't. Because it's a novel of childhood, it allowed me to write about a number of issues that are difficult for me in kind of a relatively safe way.
Mm-hmm.
That is, this book in a way deals with issues of manhood and of sexuality and of identity, but on a child's level.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was relatively easy for me to handle. And I think that's one reason why it came out as smoothly as it did. Now I have to deal with those issues on an adult level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more difficult. It's still difficult for me. And I'm still struggling, really, to find the voice and to find the form to do that.
Well, you know, some writers stay in childhood. I mean, it's not an area that's exhausted with one book. You know, deeper into
mm-hmm.
Pledge of Allegiance might be the direction.
Well, that's an interesting hint.
I've been talking to Mark Lappin, whose book Pledge of Allegiance was recently published by Dutton. It's very nice of you to have come and been with us here today.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. My guest today is Varley O'Connor, the author of Like China, a first novel published by Morrow. I had met Varley at the Squaw Valley Writers' Conference and looked forward to her book, Recently, it received a review in the New York Times, which, because brief, I wanted to quote in its entirety, also because it's a book I like a lot and which I feel has not been sufficiently attended. The book is called Like China. It's from Morrow. If, for a few pages, the story of a woman's liberation from her violent, seductive, alcoholic husband seems too familiar, just wait. With impeccable prose and rhythms as tense as any tango, Varley O'Connor interweaves Katha and Tommy Pinnell's lives with those of their neighbors, three boys on their own, abandoned by their derelict, widowed father. The setting is the Hamptons, a collection of towns that, in summer, become home to some of New York's wealthiest vacationers. The link between the Pinnells, who are renting a house near the ocean, and the sons of an impoverished local fisherman, is the youngest of the three, 8-year-old Peter, who mows the Pinnells' lawn. Missing his mother, having to follow rules his older brothers make up as they go along, he would easily understand Katha's feeling that happiness, quote, didn't seem so distant in time as it seemed oddly in space. It was as if she had moved far away to a place where she couldn't speak the language and everything was strange, to another country, like China, maybe. Ms. O'Connor astutely portrays the social brutality that turned Tommy into a wife beater, made Peter's father flee, and is quickly transforming the boys into thugs. Only Katha's passivity remains puzzling. Although she's from suburban Westchester, she might have walked straight out of a Jean Rhys novel. Nonetheless, her bond with Peter is entirely believable. It's what makes Like China a first novel that soars. Well, it must have been quite a relief to... what was your response?
Well, I was very excited about it. It took 2 months for that to happen. So, and I think it's quite astute, for the most part, the review.
I liked it, too. What did you take... what was your response to the comment about Katha's passivity?
Well, first of all, I very much admire Jean Rhys as a writer, so I was kind of
flattered.
Yes,
if you're going to be criticized, be compared to someone you admire.
Right,
yes, I think
exactly.
That's true.
And the passivity thing, well, I'm just a bit confused in that person's definition, perhaps, of the word passivity. Because I feel that Katha is very much a fighter in the book, that she is involved in a life and death struggle, and I frankly don't see her as passive at all. In the particular situation that she finds herself, some of the behaviors are also quite typical when a woman is threatened and so on, the way she is in the book.
Well, it's very interesting. Polarity that goes on in this book, as the review implies, there are two households. One of Katha's with her husband, Tommy. And Tommy is a wife beater, and one might say, therefore, someone who pays excessive attention to his wife. You know, it's that kind of pathological scrutiny that goes on in
mm-hmm.
the book. The other household is of three children who are, whose mother has died and whose father has disappeared one night. And so it's neglect, and the polarities between excessive scrutiny and complete abandonment become the poles of this novel. And it's a very mm-hmm. sort of almost scientific system
yeah.
that's investigated there.
Yeah. Well, I do think that there are links between those two things in terms of just behaviors, and of course that was real intentional in that I feel a person's being attracted into this pathologically close and observant relationship stems from certain kinds of neglect. And so I think that one in some ways enables the other, unfortunately.
I'm curious, you know, as a reader, I'm the equivalent of a wife beater. I'm a close observer of pages. And to some extent, Like China as a title is sufficiently, what would you say, remote to the content until I started to think, well, the heroine's name is Katha, Cathay, and I wondered how far you had gone. And
oh, gee, I wish I could say that. No, actually.
I didn't think so, but I thought, you know.
I did, but boy. Hopefully unconsciously.
Yes, the juices were swapping around in the universal collective unconscious.
Yes, that must have been it, definitely.
But focusing on child neglect and wife abuse, and really on very little but, you know, what led you to be interested in the construction of such a horror house of excess and diminution?
Well, boy, I mean, I think that there were definitely some personal reasons, and also maybe some literary concerns had drawn me to this. I think that those are areas that have been neglected in mainstream literature. And that haven't been really focused on. I remember very early on when I was writing the book, there were people who would criticize what I was doing. Well, you can't. No one is going to be interested enough to read a whole book about something like this. And I wanted to see if I could make that untrue. I think that it's interesting in that there are different ways of perceiving from that position, from the position of a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to explore that.
The book is full of a kind of horrific comedy, especially as the three parentless children try to invent proper, sophisticated sexual behavior. One of them, for instance, becomes attracted to Katha and is trying to be sophisticated by wearing an extremely small bikini bottom on the deserted East Hampton Beach, and he feels especially proud that he's been able to have this conversation with Katha on the beach without winking at her. I have been told that you were in the original cast of Women Behind Bars.
Oh, yeah!
and I wondered whether this horrific comedy may have had its origin somewhere in that sensibility.
Perhaps so. That's very interesting. Well, I just love that kind of thing. So it could, and that was one of the most favorite shows I ever did when I was an actress. So, you know, and that play was, Women Behind Bars, was very, very dark.
Very dark and very funny.
But so funny, you're just on the floor. And I think that works tremendously well to maybe get at the kinds of issues I'm interested in. I mean, that play had an awful lot to do with abuse.
Yes, that's what I was
saying. Rape and it, you know, the conditions in prison,
And there's so much of this book that does find itself in detention homes and social institutions.
Right, institutions.
Myself thinking, yes, the darkness and grim comedy of the institution. Now, I'm not suggesting to readers that, like China, like by Varley O'Connor, is similar to the burlesque of this play by Tom Ion, but just that there is, in its tone, a crazy enthusiasm for the untrammelable, unrestrictable characters.
Yeah. Well, I also think that that's what gets these people through. I also find a wildness and a beauty about, well, this could be taken the wrong way, but when I lived in New York City, I had opportunity sometimes to really get to know. I had a boyfriend for a while who lived on the Lower East Side. And these kids who lived in the projects, I mean, they spoke sometimes in poetry. Their imaginations, I mean, in order to survive, they had to become kind of inventive and original. And I think it's just remarkable the ways people get through things. You know, and I really admire that.
Well, that is ultimately, I think, the subject of all fiction. I know that to some extent, when one thinks of calling a writer alienated, one has to think twice, because the fact of the matter is that most writers, if they live now, are given an alienated society to write about. Mm-hmm. And it's not the alienation of the writer, it's the, you know, ongoing dissociation that surrounds us, especially if we're in that oversensitized boat that being writers and recorders puts one into.
Oh, I agree. And how do you get at that? I mean, finding an entry point, I think, is difficult at times.
Was this a painful book to write? I mean, because they're really, although eventually the youngest boy becomes a sort of savior to Katha of sorts,
mm-hmm.
And there is that light at the end of the tunnel to be writing toward, it is a fairly unhappy set of experiences to negotiate.
Yes, I think
travail. That's the word.
Yeah, travail. Very good. At times, for me, it was, but it was a book that I had to write. So, and I don't know. The humor for me was a lot of fun. So I think, in a way, maybe it was good that the boys in particular had so much levity going on, because that gave me a break. Because the voice of Katha that the boys sort of alternate with is very dark, consistently dark. And so I would write a Katha chapter, and sometimes the chapters even alternate, and then I'd go to a boys' chapter, and that'd just be a lot more fun to write, and it would kind of give me a break from that very intense voice, dark, dark voice that the other has.
Does writing a book like this free you of some of its insistent worries? Is finishing a book like this like finishing some kind of victimhood?
I think so. I mean, the way that I embark upon a book is I'm kind of obsessed with something, and there are things I want to know. If I knew everything about what the book was going to be like, I wouldn't want to write it. It wouldn't be exciting. It wouldn't be an adventure. So I, in really working with the elements that I work with, I think I do come through. I think it, yeah.
Yeah. Survivor of writing like China.
Yeah.
I am a survivor of reading Like China by Varley O'Connor, the book that we've just been discussing, and I want to thank you for coming and talking about it on Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week.
To the jungles you can go in books. The land of ice is flowing books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's books of the mouse, mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.